75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they?
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
And on tonight's UFO show, we will be dealing with several interesting stories. Some of them are fairly recent. In fact, some of them were breaking today, as a matter of fact. And then we will get into an interesting subject, at least for me, one of my favorites, and that's the UFO crash retrieval stories. This time we'll be talking about UFO crashes in Arizona. That's right, not New Mexico as usual, but Arizona. Now, these crashes in neighboring Arizona happen, in my opinion, for the same reason they happened in New Mexico, and that is that evidently during World War II and right afterwards, the U.S. Army and later the U.S. Air Force had declared war on the ETs. There is a lot of evidence about that, and we'll get into that a little bit later in the program. But basically, they were trying to protect U.S. nuclear secrets. But before we get to that, let's get to the current news breaking that I was talking about. First of all, there's this intriguing story about crop circles that comes from Indonesia. Evidently, the Indonesian Air Force, the guy in charge here, see if I can pronounce his name. Marshall's pretty easy. Inman's a second name. That's pretty easy. Then he has a name called Safad, I think. Anyway, General Safad on Monday has issued an order for helicopters to be scrambled to go take pictures of crop circles. Evidently, a farmer reported that a crop circle was formed about 6 o'clock in the morning overnight. When he got up, it was there. And so the general wants to take a helicopter picture or two of the crop circles and figure out exactly whether or not it's extraterrestrial or not. I mean, he was quoted in a news story as saying basically that. Now, it happened in Krasakan, which is a hamlet on one of the islands there in Indonesia. Sleman Island, I think, is the way you pronounce it. A resident. It says that there's huge crowds all around making their way to take a look at the crop circles formed by the UFO. And we have an interesting twist on the UFO ET disclosure subject. Listen, this is the actual sound of the Nationalist Chinese television program, a news show, that was making the announcement to the surprised Chinese public that there is indeed an effort for disclosure going on.
真人存不存在呢？ 可以说见仁见智。而美国一家八卦网站最近爆料说，美国总统奥巴马将在最近发表重要演说， 承认UFO， 也就是外星不明飞行物，
The newscaster speaking in Chinese is talking about the rumors that the Obama administration is about to make an official UFO disclosure announcement. This was made, this broadcast, on January 4th, which was before the summit in which the Chinese President Hu and Obama met in the United States. Some people are saying that one of the things on the agenda that was not announced was UFO disclosure itself. There seems to be some concern that the Chinese may jump the gun and make the official announcement before the United States. And also there's rumors other countries are continuing discussions about perhaps doing the same thing. So what's the big rush after all these years? The fact is that if the ETs really want disclosure, the first government, whether it's the United States or China or Brazil or whomever, will take a giant stride forward as far as the public relations battle is concerned. So going public could be an asset. Speaking of things going public, Friday night I was a guest on a UFO show with Jamie Havokan. And we had a caller who brought up something that I was not familiar with, another UFO crash. Interestingly enough, in our recent exposés and stories on the 1945 UFO crash near White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico at a little town called San Antonio. It has about 50 people in it. Evidently, there had been a news story about this several years ago in a mainstream newspaper in New Mexico, and no one paid much attention. Well, according to this caller, basically the same thing happened in Phoenix. Listen, here's a little bit of that call. I think you'll find it interesting.
This gets really kind of interesting. What they did a few years ago, the Arizona Republic came out and reprinted the front page of the front page from July or August of 1947. Okay.
So in the same time frame as Roswell.
Exactly the same time frame, and it even gets more interesting. Where what happened was, when it first touched down, was real close to, was within a mile of Barry Goldwater's home in the city of Paradise Valley. And it touched down and it skipped up and went back up the air and then came back down and landed to rest up at the base of Black Mountain, south of Cave Creek Carefree area. Well, you live here in the southwest too, you probably know the area I'm talking about. And it ended up by Black Mountain, and it tells about the rancher that first discovered it and how the Army showed up and all that. And they've really done a good job of kind of keeping it. You don't really much hear about that crash.
When you go up there to the Hopi Indians, did you ever get a firsthand story of them making contact with ETs or beings?
I want to tell you an incredible story. Now, my involvement with the Hopis came because I found a stone, and I found a stone next to Barry Goldwater's house. I took a Polaroid copy of it and headed up to the Hopi Reservation, and I started on Walpi, and I'm sure you're familiar with the area I'm talking about. And what I did was I went to Walpi, and I just went... because what I thought Barry Goldwater stole it from the Hopis, and somehow he might have discarded it or something because of karma or something. I don't know. It's really quite an involved story. But anyway, I started at Walpi, and I go up to all the villages and say, well, does this mean anything to you? No. And they go, no, no. And I just go from village to village to village until I went to Old Arrivee and showed the Hopis there. There was two Hopi carvers, Kachina carvers there, right? And one happened to be the great-great-grandson of a chief of Old Arrivee. And I showed him the stone. And then they got a big smile on their face and said, would you come back in 3 hours? So what they... I said, sure, we weren't doing anything. There was nothing to do up there anyways, you know, Jerry. It's kind of desolate up there.
Mm-hmm.
We went around to some of the other villages showing the stone and up at the lodge there on 2nd Mesa, you know. And then we came back in 3 hours, and they said, well, we want to show you something. So they took me down to the petroglyphs around Old Arrivee, and you probably know Old Arrivee is the oldest continuous settlement in North America. And Old Arrivee is really Jerusalem to the Native Americans when you really get to study them. So anyway, they took me out to the petroglyphs, and we went to the petroglyphs, and reading the petroglyphs is like reading a newspaper. You start taught me to read down, okay? You know, the oldest stuff's at the top, right? And the petroglyphs are, oh, God, 100,000, probably a football field high in different levels. And they pointed up at the very top of it, and they go, well, there's your stone. What there was a petroglyph of the stone. And then from there on in, they asked me to come live with them, and then I became involved with them. But on one of my trips up there, we went up there with my son, and we were talking. We were up on Old Arrivee. Now Lonnie's dad, Lonnie, came to me and said a flying saucer landed next to my dad's cornfield. We wanted to tell you, but my dad didn't want to tell anybody else. So it was time for this to start happening again. You know what I'm saying? Like their prophecies have come true. So they took me down to where the cornfields were and showed me where it landed. Like, there was no impression like that. So we spent the weekend with the thing, and then that weekend, then coming home with my youngest son, when we got just south of Winslow, about 50 to 75 miles, we saw flying saucer right over the top of the road, right in front of us. I mean, within a quarter mile. I mean, boom, right there. And then it just a lot of us.
The caller is named R.D. Slusher, and we'll get back to R.D. in a moment. He sent me the article from the Arizona Republic, and we want to talk about that. But he mentioned the Hopi Indians. And there's all kinds of Native American legends, especially in Arizona and New Mexico, about whether or not the Native Americans have had contact with ETs over the ages. And I have an interesting little bit of a show I want to play. We did this show a long time ago in Las Vegas, Nevada. And basically, it was Ted St. Rain was the guest. And Ted's been around all the UFO conferences, and he's very interested in ancient mysteries. And listen to what he has to say about the Native Americans and their early legends and ancient mysteries in Arizona. Then we'll get to the UFO crash, but listen to this.
Down in the Grand Canyon, there's supposedly an underground city that was once there. It was still there. And what happened down there was that somebody was floating down the Colorado River in about 1905, I think it was, and they were looking for minerals. And he couldn't see it from the river, but he was camping and stuff, and so he got up on a ledge and he saw a large 12 by 14 foot hole in the side of the cliff, about 1,500 feet up the side of the cliff. And he decided to go investigate it, and it took him a while to get there. He had to come down from above and stuff, and he had his rifle and his lantern and whatever. And so he found this large tunnel that went into the side of the cliff at about at about a 15-degree angle down. And what was interesting about this is that there was a ledge right where this hole went into the side of the cliff, and from there was about 30 steps that went down to what apparently was where the river had flown by before. But keep in mind, this is 1,500 feet up the side of the mountain, so this was quite some time ago that the river would have been that high. So he's trekking down into the cavern, and every so often there'd be a branch, and like it'd go into like a warrior's quarters or into a mess hall. Like the mess hall was 50 feet across by like 300 feet long and stuff. It's some sizable rooms. And he got further down, and he found like a mausoleum area that had basically had a lot of almost Egyptian sarcophagi type of arrangements that were like set up in a spoke wheel fashion around a center, like not really an altar. The altar actually comes in a minute. But anyways, there was like a mausoleum there that had these very unusual things. And as they got further down, there was like work areas. And what they did notice that all over the floor there was slag, almost like a platinum slag. And slag is once again made from when you do metal smelting, you end up with a lot of excesses. And smelting is once again firing a metal to a certain temperature to burn off certain metals and try to regain other metals out of the mix. And so basically, there's a lot of residue that's created from this process. And there was a lot of this residue all over the ground. What was very interesting is as they got down into the bottom of this city, we'll call it, there was a large like altar area that had a Chinese-looking Buddha, actually, with two saguaro cactuses on either side, all carved out of this white marble that they didn't know where it came from. It was probably 150 miles away or something where the closest marble like this came from. So anyway, this guy, this prospector, he was actually the first white man born in Utah. It was so long ago. And he gathered up some of the artifacts, and he used to work at the Smithsonian, actually. So he was floating down the river, and he got down to Yuma, and he had some of the artifacts shipped back to the Smithsonian to some friends that he has there. And they apparently had sent out a team to investigate, and it was billed as an Egyptian discovery in the Grand Canyon. And some estimates say that this could hold as many as 40 to 50,000 people.
Wow.
Was the size of this facility with probably 100 rooms. And that even further down, and there's legends among Native Americans in the area in this day that there's a back entrance, that there's an air shaft that you can actually get into this facility. The front, apparently, after the Smithsonian got involved in, and if people go to my website and read my book, you'll hear that all about the Smithsonian covering up all sorts of interesting finds. But in effect, the nature of it is that the Indians say that there's a back entrance. It's like a 7-day hike from the North Rim. And this is supposed to be...
Inside, underneath.
Once again, on the ground. And then once you get to the air shaft, apparently it's not that far. And there's, I've also heard from friends of mine who are Native Americans that they've also found other burials in the area that are non-human. But the Native Americans aren't allowing anybody to know about it because they don't want people to go in and basically scavenge the site or... but apparently there's some kind of hybrid things also in this area of the Grand Canyon. I'll just finish this story up. I didn't mean to spend this much time on it because there's other stories I want to talk about. But I'll finish it...
I want to hear both of them.
Sure. And I'll finish it up by saying that there's a legend amongst the Native Americans. I believe it was the Hopi in the area. Whoever's in that area now up by Flagstaff. And basically there's a legend amongst them that they had once been underground dwellers. And there was a race of one-hearted people and two-hearted people, they called them. And two-hearted would be like good and evil, and the one-hearted would be only good. And that basically what happened, there was a war between these one-hearted and two-hearted people, and the one-hearted people, which were basically enslaved by the two-hearted people, had basically broken away and been freed from underground, from slavitude underground. And this is all right in that same area. Now, into the next story, down in a little place called Maricopa, south of Phoenix, north of Tucson, out in the desert on the way to Mexico, there's a little ghost town now called Maricopa. And in the 1890s, they were digging a basement for a commercial building, and at about the 8-foot level, they came across a large clay sarcophagus again. And what they did is they called in some engineers and some workmen, and they cracked open this sarcophagus, and they found a granite mummy case inside. Once again, this is just south of Phoenix, about 50 miles south of Phoenix, and. In any case, so they found this large clay sarcophagus, cracked it open. There was a red granite sarcophagus inside of it. They cracked that open. Apparently, the bones, it had been in the ground for so long that the bones had all turned to dust. They could see that there was some kind of mummy, like an Egyptian mummy in there. And in effect, on the outside of the sarcophagus, there were some hieroglyphic depictions and a depiction of a being that had 6 toes. The other unusual thing about the sarcophagus is it held an individual that was about 12 feet tall. We'll just stay on the giant thing, so that finishes that one up. We'll stay on the giant thing. Once again, these are most of the common ones that maybe some of your viewers have heard about before. There's a lot more in my book that people should go check out.
Literally has been a land of the giants.
Land of the giants. There's another place north of Reno called Lovelock, Nevada. And in Lovelock, back once again, about 1910 or so, there was some people mining bat guano in the caves above Lovelock, Nevada. And they kept coming across these large skeletons, 10, 12 feet tall. Most of them had red hair. And they let the universities of New York and Berkeley and all these, scientific and archaeological universities know about it. But it was about a year before anybody sent somebody out, and only on an unofficial, quote-unquote, basically as unofficial observers, they were called. And even then, they were mostly interested in the part shards and in fact, in some cases, they instructed the workers to rebury, like, full skeletons. They didn't even want to look at them. Once again, 1910, so you could understand that this would be a problem, having a 12-foot human skull, human being. And these skulls, once again, there's pictures on the website, www.lostartsmedia.com, of some of these skulls that are about, twice the size of a human skull, 12 feet, 12-foot skeletons. So some of the workmen were so discouraged with the official response to all this that they basically did the best they could, gathering up some artifacts. And actually, before they even sent them out in that year that had passed, between the time they notified them and between the time they arrived, a lot of the artifacts had been destroyed because they were there to mine back guano. They weren't there for an archaeological dig and stuff. So one of the head workmen took it upon himself to basically gather up whatever he could and make a makeshift museum in the city of Lovelock at the time, which actually operated for probably 10 years. But then, as usually the case in a lot of these things, a fire ran through the museum and basically destroyed a lot of the artifacts that were there. There's still, from what I understand, one of the skulls at the... I'm not sure. Once again, you have to go to the website. I think it might be at the Idaho Historical Society, but that might be another reference.
That's Ted St. Rame with a little bit of a sidebar story on Indian or Native American legends with the Hopis. And we'll do more shows on that as well, but let's get back to this Phoenix UFO crash and the article in the Arizona Republic. Jim Delatosa is quoted in the Arizona Republic in this article, and we'll try to get a hold of Jim. We've never had him on the air. We've been talking about him to other people for a long time, so this is a good excuse to get Jim on. Maybe we'll do that next week or at least a week or two from now. And we want to talk to him about this UFO incident, this crash in Phoenix. And I want to thank R.D. Slusher for sending us the article from the Arizona Republic and calling my attention to it. It happened in the Cave Creek Dam area, and according to a witness quoted in the newspaper article and found by Delatosa, there were some ETs dead in the crash, and they were put evidently in a nearby home inside the freezer down in the basement for a time. A fellow by the name of Walt Sawyer evidently had a ranch near there and had a big freezer in the basement, and that's where he put the ET bodies. It's an interesting story, certainly piques my interest. We're going to have to get more information about it for sure, about the ET bodies and whatever happened. It's kind of glossed over in the article. The crash happened about 3 months after Roswell, by the way, and the man, his name was Graves, who saw it from a nearby hill, described it as an aluminum-shaped disc that had a dome on top and had crashed into the hill. Later, the Air Force restricted the area, and finally, they bulldozed most of it in a helter-skelter way, in a fashion that really made no sense to anybody watching. And then later, guess what? This entire area became the Cave Creek landfill. As I say, as soon as we can get it together, we'll do a follow-up on this reported UFO crash there in Phoenix. And as you heard the caller say, it's very close to where Barry Goldwater used to live. But let's talk about another UFO crash in Arizona. This one happened in Kingman, Arizona in 1953. And according to legend or reports or rumor or whatever you want to call it, at least one ET survived and maybe two. One story is that one ET ended up in Los Alamos and the other one ended up at Area 51. And we'll talk about that here in a moment. But first of all, let's talk a little bit about the crash itself. And once again, we return to a program we did in Las Vegas. And this time at Sunset Station, we are talking to a fiction writer, an author, and let's present that interview with Robert Farrell.
Let's talk a little bit about this actual crash in Kingman in 1953. A lot of people don't know about that.
I know. They know about Roswell.
Wendell Stevens once told me that he knew of at least 10 crashes in Arizona altogether.
I talked to Wendell personally for about 45 minutes to get more information on this crash. And, in fact, on one of my visits out this way, I was in Laughlin, Nevada at the time, I actually drove to where I think the crash site is, which is about 10 miles north of the Kingman Airport. I wanted to get the lay of the land, so when I described some of the events in my book, I had the terrain laid out correctly. I tried to be as accurate as I could with all the evidence and scientific information that I give in my book.
10 miles north of the airport in Kingman, what exactly happened there? Was something recovered or?
Yes, a UFO apparently crashed and was recovered and taken someplace. Some people today think maybe that's Area 51.
What did you do any research while you were there in Kingman, or just take a look at the place and get a lay of the land?
I didn't have time to actually spend much time doing research there. I just mostly got the lay of the land. I took my GPS with me, so I had the coordinates on a map and everything.
I go to the conference in Laughlin. I wish I'd known you were going up there. I'd gone with you with a recorder. That would have been fun.
That's the one I was at, as a matter of fact.
Yes. Yeah, and now, any ETs or alien beings in this crash that you know of?
I'm not sure. I don't know of them, put it that way.
Yeah, right. Was probably a typical saucer-type craft.
Yes, it was.
You know, it's interesting that all of this things that happened 47-52, of course, you had all of the things flying over the capital of Washington, D.C., and 53, this crash.
Yes.
Lots of activity back in that time frame. Not that there's not now. We just had a report the other day on our UFO Files show about a sighting near Kingman, as a matter of fact. So they're still showing up.
Yeah. One of the things that's intrigued me, and actually it didn't occur to me until after I finished the book, and I asked the question here at the conference, and I'm not sure I got the answer that I was looking for, but the question that I posed was, these UFOs, with all their sophistication, being built by probably a civilization that's a million years technically more advanced than us, why are they crashing? How can such a craft that's as beautiful and does the things that it does crash? So that was one question I asked. And I'm researching that, by the way.
Well, I've always assumed that these early crashes, 47, 52, 53, had something to do with the radar we used at the time.
I think you're right. I think that's what I'm finding out. Some may be due to lightning strikes, but take the Kingman crash, for instance. That was in May 20th, 1953. And they don't have a lot of lightning storms in Kingman that time of year.
No, they don't. I understand that the radar they're using, especially in 47, probably still in 53, was very akin to a microwave oven.
Yeah. Actually, when you read my book, Corey, who is the astrophysicist and very interested in UFOs, almost to the detriment of his career, but at one point in the book, the colonel who's in charge of the program, standing next to this crashed UFO in this secret base and asking him some questions about how it works. And Corey describes how it's worked by gravity, and he talks about how he feels that somehow they've learned to manipulate electromagnetic fields to create or distort gravitational fields. Now, if that's true, then electromagnetic fields like microwave radiation might disrupt their drive systems. And except for the crash in Kingman, which may not be related to radar, other than the fact that I discovered that there's a place called Radar Hill in Kingman, and that also that some research was done in the late 50s, and I'm not sure whether it goes into 53 or not, on developing radar that was used in the Dew Line.
Did you run across anybody in Kingman that knew anything about that UFO crash?
Interesting. When I got back, I live in Phoenix, and I was doing some research with my cell phone, a marvelous invention.
Yes, it is.
And so I called the library there, asking for some information about the weather and everything in Kingman, Arizona in 1953, in May of 53. And she referred me to another gentleman, which unfortunately I can't remember his name. And he called me back, and we were talking, and at the time I didn't tell him what I was.
Yes, I
didn't say anything about a crash and of UFOs, and he opened that subject up.
He did?
Yeah, so he was right on top of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Had he seen it or just heard about it?
He knew about it. Yeah. Apparently the people in Kingman are aware that such a thing happened.
So as you can see, there have been UFO crashes not only in New Mexico, but also in Arizona. We'll have more on Kingman and also Phoenix in a later show. Right now, let's get back to the Phoenix Lights. And before we do that, even, I'm going to present a little bit of a show that we did on location in North Phoenix up by Sandra O'Day O'Connor High School. We had a report from Rod Krotowski out there that basically they were having trouble keeping security guards in the neighborhood. Sandra O'Day O'Connor, I'll get it right in a minute, high school is right behind a haunted area, evidently. And we'll talk about that. The security guards would just suddenly quit. They would leave. Not only was there some hauntings going on, some red fog coming down, reportedly mist, but also lots of UFO activity. And we're going to present this because this is the first time I saw a UFO. I was actually doing a broadcast, so listen. Lots of strange things happen in Phoenix. There have been reports, of course, of the Phoenix Lights. We still have lights down in South Mountain area. People still see things around. We'll have Mike Fortson on later this week, and he'll be talking about seeing things in Prescott Valley. A lot of it's spiritual or paranormal, but there's a UFO element as well. And we are here in North Phoenix, right by the Sandra Day O'Connor High School. The Sandra Day O'Connor High School is a big complex, but they have trouble keeping security guards at night. They leave suddenly. They say a red mist comes down the hill and envelops the school sometimes, at least the back part of it. Hello, this is Jerry Pippin, and we are continuing with our Phoenix Lights special. We are in Phoenix, actually North Phoenix, and a couple of Twin Peaks type mountains right here in the behind me. And we have Rob Krotowski here, who lives down the street. First of all, Rob, give us a little background. Tell the audience where we are and why.
This is on the road next to the ruins, which is right below the ceremonial site, which is neatly tucked in between these two hills that we're looking at right there. Actually, if you see, in the center of the mountain right there.
Mm-hmm.
Now you know, you were telling me that you were out here a couple of hours earlier and actually saw something, huh?
No, it was actually from my patio, which is going to be right on the other side of that knoll, which is where I'd done a lot of the taping. Had some lights coming. I just saw one flash up there just now. One light came out, and all of a sudden, two appeared next to it. And, it, you know, it was, wasn't real spectacular, but, it always is not the spectacular things. That's kind of rare, but
I believe there's, besides the burial mounds here, there's some, is there some quartz around here?
Yeah, the mountain, just about a quarter of a mile beyond this one, has a very large quartz vein that you can see. It's kind of a distinguishing feature running through it. And it kind of slopes down right into this area right here. It's kind of neat. There's a small ruins right where we're standing right here, about, 150 yards into the desert. And then tucked in between those hills is the Circle of Stones ceremonial site. So,
How long have you been noticing these lights here?
From June 14th when I first saw the lights, I guess that triggered me to pay attention, I guess. But we had things in the past. See at the very top up there.
Yeah, you see that up there, Roberta? Talking to Roberta Scott, our producer. And it's a cool night. Does the weather have anything to do with it?
No, it's been... the weather doesn't really have much to do with it, but, I've only been looking into this for a few months, and, whoa.
How would you describe to our listeners what these lights are that we're looking at exactly? Are they orbs or just flashes of light?
You know, I'm not sure. It's nothing really spectacular, but just this is kind of the subtler little light change. You know,
what's this look like in the daytime?
It's a nice, pretty mountain with lots of black basalt lava, rocks intermixed with the, you know, the desert and do with the moon being out. But the very top of that knoll right there too is, I guess, what we call the fortress. Is just rocks that have kind of been laid out in a circle, kind of like fortifying the top of the mountain. I'm not sure what it was used for, but.
Have you been to the top of that mountain? You've climbed up there?
Yeah, I've been all throughout the mountains here, and you got everything from caves, mines, to the ruins, to petroglyphs. It's very diverse, and it's in its interesting, you know, little. Here and there, you have all these different little things that kind of makes it a neat little place.
Now, Roberta, why don't you tell our listeners what you and Rod just saw there as we walk a little over here to where you are.
I saw a light that looked like a puff of smoke. Yeah, and I saw it. I just now saw it again.
Oh, really?
Okay, now where she's looking, that is what now?
It's right in between the two hills right here that we're looking at. And that's where the light was, and that's where a lot of things seem to come right out of there. I don't know. I'm not scared of it, but, you know.
About a 50-50 chance anytime you come up here, you'll see something.
Huh? Yeah. I'd say maybe even a little bit more. You know, a lot of it's just subtle, but definitely anomaly.
Right up there at the left.
What do you see?
Well, It kind of just looks...
What is that, a red cloud?
Mm-hmm. Well, I just saw it again. It's just like a blink of light that looks like it's smoke that's red.
Like if it was inside a distortion area, or smoke.
Somewhat like sometimes when we have the UFO reports about, they say, well, it's kind of... kind of fogs it out, cloaks out.
Yeah, it's definitely whatever's going on here does have some distortion attached to it in some way. In fact...
Yeah, you're talking toward the edge of the... Yeah. You're right, as dips in the middle between the two hills.
Mm-hmm.
And now, have you ever been here late at night or early in the morning, or is there any certain time it really is right after sunset, or when...
Right after sunset, and... when it's most dark, this isn't really the ideal time, but the ruins just recently got dug up over here, and I've been here, well, I first been to these ruins about 15 years ago, so probably, you know, on and off, you know, every year or other year, you know, all during that time, and they've never been really messed with until... You know, about it was about a month and a half ago. So I thought that was, and there's still boards out in there, like someone was covering up, digging and then covering it up with boards. So I don't know. Maybe some other people have some interest in, just because, you know, it's an archaeological site, unique and old.
I wonder what Indians were here. Do we know, or it goes back before for that?
Hohokam, but this is one of the older. Sites, and the archaeologist that was out here with me told me this is definitely a ceremonial or shaman's site, because there's only three buildings, not a whole lot of pottery, so it wasn't a highly people weren't living here necessarily in large numbers or for a long time, so it was probably some place where you'd come when you had a ceremony or worship or something.
What do you figure this is? You must have a hunch.
Oh, gosh, I have no idea. But there's some properties of this being an area of coming and going, I guess you might say, because things are seemingly coming out of here, and more coming than going, but definitely seems like a place, what would you say, you know, a door, I guess?
A portal. A portal would be a good term. Okay, we'll be right back. We're in right outside or to the north of Phoenix, and we'll be right back after this word. Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazel. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of jerrypippin.com. Hello, this is Jerry Pippin. We're on location on a dark, cool night. We're in far north Phoenix, at the end of the line as far as the city is concerned, at the foot of an Indian burial ground and two twin mountains. There's something happening, and we're trying to find out what it is as we continue with our story of the Phoenix Lights.
I saw a light that looked like a puff of smoke. Yeah, and I just now saw it again.
Really?
Okay, now where she's looking, that is what now?
It's right in between the two hills right here that we're looking at. And that's where the light was. And that's where a lot of things seem to come right out of there.
There, at the left.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not scared of it, but...
Well, it kind of just looks...
What is that, a red cloud?
Mm-hmm. Well, I just saw it again. It's just like a blink of light that looks like it's smoke that's red.
We're outside on location, literally, and we're trying to find out a little bit about what's happening here in North Phoenix. As you know, there are all kinds of mysterious things that people have been paying attention to now since the beginning of the Phoenix Lights on March 13, 1997. And probably people were noticing these things before that as well. Mysterious, for sure. And Roberta Scott is one of our producers, and she's here with me. And we have Rob Grotowski and some other people we'll introduce here in a moment. As we came out here to the burial ground, and a Native American burial ground, and these two mysterious peaks... Oh, I don't know. They look like they go up a couple of thousand feet, don't you think? Anyway, Roberta was busy scouting out the area as we were unloading our equipment. And what have you been seeing, Roberta?
Well, whenever you look at it, because some of it is so quick, and like there was like a little yellow burst of like a little candlelight flicker, and it's there, and then it's gone, and you keep looking in a place, and then you have something that looks like a big round puff of smoke, and then it's gone. But right now, there's one spot that's staying there quite a bit.
Uh-huh. Area. Ooh. Do you see that light?
Yes, I did.
That might be a plane coming, though.
Yeah, that is an airplane, or something.
Not always.
I believe it's a plane, though.
It could be an airplane, yes. But
it's hard to tell. We are definitely seeing something here. What do you think it is?
I'm not sure. It's almost like there's little...
Now that's an airplane over the top of that coming in, isn't it?
Yeah, and one over there, too. I mean... There's always, that one looks, you can tell, is a lot different than the other one.
Oh, yeah. But there's flickers that are right above it and come down the mountain, little flickers.
Yeah, like it's snowing a little bit of other lights.
They look like fireflies if you were looking at something up close.
Yeah, like almost embers.
And we mentioned the whole thing because there are airplanes around, but these are not planes that we're talking about at this time. What would you think, Sue?
Well, you just see little flicks of light.
So, yeah, and I know there's about three or four of my neighbors that I see out when I'm out,
And on certain occasions, we all were oohing and aahing, and we all knew what we were talking about. We were doing.
Now, what about this, like, the peeking over the peak there now? Is that an airplane?
Possibly. But there is a very strange airplane that we get here. And I think it's some type of observation plane, because when it comes over the mountain, it turns on four lights that it has on its bottom of its wings, and they're blindingly bright, and they seem to want to illuminate some area of the mountain when it comes over the mountain, just specifically because then as it goes off, you can see it turn the lights.
But you think it is an airplane with just some sort of lights?
I've been literally illegally flying over the mountain, like 25, 50 feet over the top of the mountains, you know, shaking the house almost. So I've been able to, you know, film it where I'm, you know, I can't zoom in anymore or I'd be on a tire.
Is it a prop plane or a jet?
It's like it's a jet, but it's a weird sounding jet. Modern, I guess you'd say, or hybrid or something.
And up there, you think that might be that plane again? It's coming a little closer.
It's got three lights that are not going off or blinking, which is kind of strange.
And it doesn't look like landing lights to me, but I don't know.
They're blinking, and they look like they're shining up. That's weird. You want to take a look at it, Jared?
Well, it might be shining a light down on it, because if you look below it, it almost looks like... Wow, that's bright.
And there's no noise from this angle. It's triangular in shape. Roberto, take a look at it and see if you think that's a flying triangle. And take a picture of it if you can. It's silent and it's not making any noise and it's making fairly good time. I would say, what is that, 1,500, 2,000 feet up?
No, I got the noise. But it's not loud and it's kind of weird. Oh, it just had a light below it. Before it goes away, you want to look at it?
Yeah.
It might be a jet, and we're just. But it's a strange noise if it is.
It's you can hardly hear it. I don't. If that's even it, the noise that we're hearing.
I'm not sure that's what we're hearing.
Yeah, because it was very close to us. We should have been able to hear something.
Here, take your binoculars back. I couldn't make out a shape of it. Could you? Now, this other light over here, I think, is an airplane.
Yeah, that looks like one. But
the other light seems to have disappeared completely.
Yeah, no, it's still in the air, though. I got it. It's just sitting there. I can see this through the binoculars, and that is weird. Where'd it go?
I don't know what it is. It is like
a shooting star.
Yeah, it's just kind of hanging there now. It's moving a little bit.
It's not that. It's very hard to see. You can't hardly see it unless you have
weird. It's like there's spider webs in front of us, and that where you'll get glimmer off the spider webs a little bit as you move the binoculars around. There we go. But it's not light artifacts, because I know what that is. I've seen them a lot. It's emanating something, it looks like. But if you look below it with the binoculars, it looks like spider webs.
Like a hall of mirrors in front of it.
Well, I've always heard that if you ask them for a show, you'll get one. And we're getting it pretty interesting.
It hasn't failed since I've brought people down here. It's always been adequately weird anyway.
When you had your UFO researchers here a couple of weeks ago, they came away fairly impressed, I take it.
Oh, yeah. One was fairly shaken, and the other one was he was a fearless guy, and he, you know, couldn't be strange enough for him. But, you know, they both were very taken aback by it, and they call me all the time now. Is anything going on? And they make it up here every chance they get. It has been kind of interesting. I've seen a lot weirder things happen, but there's definitely some unconventional or unexplainable lights that we've seen.
And something's happening over on the top of the hill now. In between there and the little dip, there's a light again. Is that smoke?
It's not smoke. I know it kind of looks like it, but it's just a distortion, and you can see it emanating in straight lines. Now it's at an angle to the right, to the southeast, so I don't know what it is. But I'd like to get some instruments up there. Helicopter. This place has always got... I'm surprised we haven't seen any tonight, but helicopters have always coming over here, shining lights around. I say always, you know. I probably see them once a week or more. And before we thought anything of it, before we even saw any lights, we'd always kid with my wife, why do they do all these car chases and they always end up stopping here, the criminal here, and it's kind of funny that we, you know, just kind of wrote it off as a funny thing, and now I think differently about it, that they're checking something out.
Rob, you and Rick, I want to go up there to Pinnacle Peak. Can we get up there? Is there a way back behind the school over there, maybe, huh? Roberta, come on, you can go with us. You came 1,200 miles with me. Let's get up there. I want to see. They say there's a door up there into the rock. Let's see if we can get up there. We'll be right back, folks, with our Phoenix Lights investigation of the mysterious lights and other things in North Phoenix. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com.
Commercial break. We've moved about 20 minutes north from where we earlier were. We're near Pinnacle Peak, I think, right, Rob?
Thereabouts, yeah.
And most of this stuff happens at night, huh?
Yeah, I would say most of it happens at night. And whether that's due to the fact that you can see it better at night or the actual activity happens at night, I don't think is clear. But, yeah, you can see it better at night.
Were you in Phoenix during the original Phoenix Light time of the 1997 one?
Yes, I was.
Did you see anything?
No, I did not.
In fact, you weren't really aware of UFOs, at least, and not seeing them until fairly recently.
Right. It was UFOs were probably the same category as Loch Ness Monster for me. I mean,
we're at a different view of this Twin Peaks area, these two mountaintops. And Rob Klikosky, we have with us also Rick Diogiano. And Rick, we're looking at your car. You have an interesting license tag.
It's the letters CNUFOs.
And that pretty well describes your website and what you've been doing.
A year ago, almost to the day, I've been catching a lot of night orbs, and 70 to 80% of my sightings are in the day. Catch a lot of white orbs and morphing objects and objects that burst into golden orbs and back into a egg shape.
Now, do you live close to this area or where else than Phoenix?
I live 10 miles to the southeast of here.
Okay, so Rob lives the furthest north.
Yep, so far, yeah. And And it seems like a lot of the objects head in this direction or come from this area. So it's kind of like I'm in a path of wherever all the traffic is going.
I want to talk to you about the daytime sightings here in a moment, but you were telling me something interesting on the way over here about they seem to have a schedule.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it seems like, and now I'm kind of figuring it out. When it first started up last April, I was seeing these night orbs around 10:30 at night. And as the summer progressed, it seemed like every day it was like an extra minute or 5 to 10 minutes later I would start seeing them. Now in the wintertime, I would see them at 5 a.m. till 6 a.m, and now I'm seeing them at between 4 and 5. And it seems like they were in the western sky, and now they seem to be moving over my head and appearing over my head and moving east. And that's where they were in the summer. They were showing up in the eastern sky, and now they're showing up overhead, moving towards the east, it seems like.
You're saying they come in the evening around 7:30 or 8 or something?
Yeah, right now the time moved up a little bit. It's about 7:30, between 7:30 and 8 o'clock. You get a big cluster. You'll see 3 or 4 in a row, and then you won't see anything at all.
And then they come back early in the morning. Almost an 8-hour shift there.
Yeah. They're working full-time, actually.
No part-time ETs.
No, no. Honestly, you won't see anything. I can go out between 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning and won't see anything. But right around 5:15, they start showing up. And they come in, you know, come in cycles. It's just hard to tell. You can see one, you can see 15 of them.
Now, were you around in 97 when the first big flap of Phoenix lights showed up?
Yeah, unfortunately, I was here and didn't see it. But I did see a bright orange orb 1 month to the day right after that in April. So, but ever since then, no, I didn't see anything until last year. So I missed out on that.
So, but all of a sudden, you become aware of a lot of activity.
Yeah.
What about these daytime sightings? What are you actually seeing?
Oh, man, you name it.
Are we talking about just like Rob, you're walking out of your backyard and taking a look?
Yes, yes, actually I am. I go out in my backyard, and I kind of get a feeling to go out there. It's real weird. I just all of a sudden go, I got to go outside, and then I'll look up, and I'll see anything. I can see discs, you know, morphing objects, red worms. Really, the objects seem like they're alive sometimes. You know, they change shape. And
in fact, I talked to a fellow today that insists he thinks some of them are alive.
Yeah, I have really weird video. It looks like I have a dinosaur in the sky, and it appeared out of nowhere and hung around for about an hour. And
so the dinosaur looks pretty akin to a flying dragon. So maybe the mythology wasn't all that far off.
You would think. Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, I'm catching a bunch of weird stuff, and a lot of them are the white orbs, but, yeah, once in a while you get something that just really shocks you.
How about unique videos?
Yeah, my favorite one is on page 4 right now. It's called a red worm, and it's an object that was red, white, and blue balloons, so we thought, and it turned out to hover over our house, stretch out, and change color, and then split into many pieces and go in all directions, so... I have that up there. I also have a huge triangular craft, is what I'm calling it. It was on October 14th. You can look it up on there. It's on
October 4th,
2004. Of 04, right, yeah. And also I have a new one up I just put up. It's of a craft that just appeared over my house during a storm, and I didn't know at the time. I called it ball lightning, but it turned out to be a triangular craft, so that's up there now, too.
You know, they say, in fact, we had Bill Hamilton on here a little earlier, and he said he had reports... back here in 97, one of those triangle craft being a mile and almost mile and an eighth long, 10,000 feet.
Yeah. Oh, I believe it. I have one. Actually, that's another one of my favorites that I caught on page 4 on my video section is three orbs, you know, three lights that form a perfect triangle.
Yes,
and
uh-huh.
It was huge. I can't tell you how big it was, but it could have been a mile wide.
And so that was probably lights on each end.
Yeah, it was perfect triangle.
Perfect.
Yeah. Anyway, I taped it for 5 minutes, right over the house, right over Scottsdale, and it just hovered and went behind the clouds. And
my first question is, why Phoenix? I mean, definitely lots of activity here.
Yeah, it seems like it's always been here from what I've been hearing, talking to other sky watchers that have been doing this way longer than me. But it seems like the activity is just, I don't know, just come out of nowhere. Everybody seems to be seeing it. So, I mean, I can tell you what time to go out, and you can see these night orbs, so... It's not like they're hiding anymore, it seems like.
It's almost like they're doing a show for you.
Yeah, Yeah, and kind of like a little schedule here and there, you know. You can catch them at the same time every night.
And, do you draw any conclusions from that? I mean, some people, as we mentioned earlier, figure some of these things are living beings up there. I'm not so sure about that, but they do look that way.
Yeah, I know. Well, some of the video that I caught, it can just make you scratch your head as to what it is and what they're doing up there or what it is. I have no idea what they are, but I don't know what their agenda is either. I haven't been abducted that I know of. No weird dreams or anything like that, but you do have interesting things that appear in the house. I have seen balls of energy in the house, and our lights have gone off and for no reason. Where, you know,
now when we stand out here by these Twin Peaks, and we kind of need to describe it to everyone, we're actually in a residential area with a public facility down the street. Like this light over there, that's probably an airplane, right?
Yeah, it definitely looks like an airplane.
So we want everybody to know that we can tell a difference. And up into over your shoulder there, that's definitely a star.
Yeah, that's definitely a star. Yeah,
probably.
Maybe.
I think it's Sirius. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it. So we can tell the difference. Now, these mountains, they're really got an interesting look to them. Anyway, they almost glow.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they kind of have their own field, it seems like, of energy, and you can actually see the distortion field coming down the mountain sometimes right up to your camera. It's real noticeable.
And Rob has been over there with his camera in the dark. Rob, how are we doing? Are we getting anything yet? I've never ceased to be amazed by the way that the whole peak area just kind of glows. It's like it's translucent almost.
It glows a little bit, and actually we've been watching the flashes over there, and so I'm putting it on my things to-do list here to when we get back to the house to check Doppler radar and see if there is lightning in the area.
But, yeah, I don't think there is. It doesn't appear to be.
There's not a cloud in the sky.
No.
But I don't know. Did you see that, Rich, flash over there just now?
Yeah.
They're getting some flashes behind the institution here.
Last time we were here, we had some flashes of lightning, but maybe not as definite as this time.
Yeah, I just saw two of them. So the flashes are located where the people that I had a meeting with.
It's right over by them, right?
Yeah, interesting.
Now they've been seeing some sort of lack of a better term. Pillar-like object that's gaseous or smoky?
Yeah, they described it pillar distortion, water column type of movement through the grounds there. And I guess it's very similar to what I've got on videotape. I just have described it a little bit different way. I've described it as a column of distortion, column of water is definitely could be described the same way what I seen. So
yeah,
I just saw.
Yeah. There goes again. We talk about this. You each time you say you don't have to wait very long, and you don't.
No. It's pretty much a very subtle nightly occurrence that turns into, on occasion, something that's very much other than subtle.
Now, was this sacred Indian land or something?
Yeah, we're about 100 yards from three old ruins. Now, they're kind of come off the mountain in a line here. The archaeologist that I was here with said that the site is probably a more of a ceremonial site, or one that was occupied by a medicine type man, just because there's not a whole lot of pottery. I mean, there's pottery you can readily find out there, but it's not a pottery deposit like you would find in a heavily habitated ruin. It seems to be more used on occasions. And
What do we see here?
We see some kind of rolling distortion over there, and another flash up just over the mountain. So, yeah, they've got a little activity.
Yeah, it's over there, and when you call it rolling distortion, why don't you explain to our audience what we're talking about? It's almost translucent, and I mean, you can see it.
Yeah, you can definitely see it. It looks like when you look down the highway or a street in the summertime and you can see the heat, you know, kind of the wavy action, but you can see it coming down the mountain sometimes, and it comes right up to the camera.
And we're talking about something being pitch dark out here, even with a moon.
Right.
And the last time we were out here, it was really dark.
Yeah, yeah.
So it would have to glow or at least be seen somehow.
It's somehow, yeah. You can see it. It's just, you can see there's something. It's just doesn't look like the rest of the mountain. It's a little blurry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's how you can tell.
You have any ideas about this? Is very puzzling to me.
You know, I don't know, unless there's a vortex here or there's some sort of energy field underneath or it's the rocks that are in the mountain. I don't know. I just saw a flash of light right on the base of the mountain over here, too, as I was talking to you.
Have you ever been up here on this mountain in the daytime?
No, we came here at sunset last year, and we all had video cameras. There was three of us here. And all of a sudden, Rob goes, "Are there two over there by you?" Because I'm like, "Well, no, I don't see anything." And then we played back the video, and there was all these white lights popping up around me.
Wow.
Like I was the center of attention for some reason.
They were taking a look at you.
Oh, yeah, there were several. There was like five or six of them. And I just freaked out when I saw it. I'm like, "You got to be kidding me." It was in the bush. You can see the bush light up. Yeah, that was really cool. I have that on my website, too.
You know, are you using a video camera now or a still camera?
This is just a video camera, okay. Regular Sony Handycam with the zoom.
And when you look out your backyard, you live in Scottsdale, right, or close to there?
Well, I live right by Desert Ridge, which is 5 minutes from Scottsdale.
Do you see anything of, you know, these shimmering things, or have you ever seen any of that over there?
No, nothing at all like that. You know, like I said, I really don't even have to leave my backyard to see anything, so what I see is generally coming overhead. So, no rolling distortion by my house, that's for sure.
Okay, we're broadcasting here outside next to the Twin Peaks, and both these gentlemen have been seeing quite a few things. It's been fairly recent, too. They were probably here before. You just weren't really tuned in to it, probably.
Absolutely, yeah. Like I said, I mean, people have been seeing this stuff for years, and I'm just new to it. So I guess it's my turn.
One of the things I find that's interesting is right up a couple of miles from here, I think they have the university has some rocks and sculptures and things they've found over the years, and they've got some drawings that look very similar to some of the things that we see.
Right, yeah, you can see the from what I've seen. I haven't seen them personally, but, yeah, they show the stars in the sky moving and other things.
Yeah,
you know,
a complete little flash of light straight across. I saw it shimmering. It's almost like an airport beacon, only not really.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you saw it, yep.
Yeah. As we were talking, it caught a sight of my eye. Now down in South Mountain, we were talking to Jeff today, and
right.
He says that he's found lots of these drawings, and they look exactly like what he's seeing.
Yeah, I heard about that. I understand that these drawings are all over the valley, and you can just basically hike anywhere and see them.
I'll go over and ask Roberta if she's seen anything, Old Eagle Eye herself. Have you spotted anything tonight?
Yes, and we're going to go and investigate.
Where are we going to go investigate at?
Over by on the other side of this mountain.
We're going to get in the car and go over there, or we're going to walk over the mountain?
No, we're going to get in the car. We'll get a little bit closer.
Road open for me. The people that...
Oh, they did.
Yeah, so we can drive right back to Bumpy. Okay.
Okay, well, I guess I'll ride with her, and we'll meet you over there. Yeah, you probably better take it. We're going to break down here and go to the other side of the mountain. How does that sound?
I can't wait. This sounds great.
Okay.
Hello, I'm Anthony Miles, director of the award-winning motion picture Fast Walkers, They Are Here. It's my pleasure to introduce you to our new series of explosive and revealing one-on-one interviews entitled Fast Walkers, Open Files. Our first volume, Fast Walkers Open Files Volume 1, features well-known and respected Texas journalist and best-selling author investigator Jim Mars, whose books Alien Agenda, Crossfire, and Rule by Secrecy have sold millions of copies worldwide. His explosive revelations will astound and satisfy listeners who thirst for truth and forthright commentary. Also featured in Volume 1 is internationally respected talk show host Jerry Pippin. Also presented in Volume 1 is the respected world-class futurist Alfred Lambermont Weber, the founding father of exopolitics. And be sure to check the FastWalkers.com website on a regular basis for the upcoming release of additional FastWalkers Open Files volumes.
Okay, we are now off of the main road, and we're in a rocky path that's really built for SUVs. We have a Vibe there. We're in kind of a miniature SUV, so Roberta, I think we'll make it okay, but it's pretty bumpy, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Going up a hill here, and this is literally the south part of that mountain. I guess so. Maybe we're going to the north end of the mountain. That's probably be more correct. We're on the east side of it right now. And so we are in pretty rough going here, but we're still going to make it, I'm pretty sure, because it is very, very, very bumpy. Okay, he's going to... I think that's as far as he wants you to come, Roberta. You can't go any further.
No, I can't.
No. Okay, we're going to stop and get out and walk up here and see what's happening.
Let's see. Probably just turn the lights off and see what we can see.
Yeah, turn the lights off, I guess.
Turn the lights off and we'll see.
Okay, now we're probably on the east side of this mountain now.
We're on the east side of the mountain. And obviously... there's not a cloud in the sky because I'm seeing lights on the horizon, so we don't have any clouds in the area. Could be making...
Yeah, Rich, there's no clouds, no rain, no thunderstorms around here.
No, nothing at all. Nothing threatening anyway.
Light just popped up right there.
Like that red light flashing?
Yeah. Or is that an airplane?
It's probably an airplane.
I'll check it out.
Okay, we see a light. It may be an airplane. We're checking it out. Rich is looking through his video camera with the zoom, and we'll see what we can see here. It's interesting enough, in the desert, you can feel the cool breeze at night this time of year.
Yeah, sure is. Nice and cool back here.
And, of course, the full moon or a moon pretty close to it over those peaks. And so there's really basically what you're saying, exterior reason for light. So it looks to me like it may be coming from the interior somehow.
Well, we saw the flashes actually showing up in the side of the building. So to me it would kind of, well, actually lightning's not even a... a factor now either. So yeah, it would seem like they were the flash source was between the far north mountain that we're looking at right now and the place where we were looking as lookies.
Rich and Rom, I guess the main thing we can establish from this distance is that there's no reason for that light source for that flashing light.
That's the main
there's no
thing
lightning
we've established here. And that.
Shine your light down there on the, that does look like the what used to be a door. It's covered up by cement or something.
Basically, we've gone about as far as we can go.
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
going to get out of here.
Right. You're going to have to do some backing, I guess.
It gets dark. It gets dark.
Oh, yeah. It's dark back here. And interestingly enough, it's where we just found a fault back here, which is... going to be about 500 to 800 yards just due north of this position. There's a fault in a layer of what we think is barium deposit.
Rich, and Rob, thanks for taking us up here. And Roberta, thanks for driving me up here in your Vibe. It'll be a long back down the mountain. I wonder what they use as roadlines. We did see some strange things. Something seems to glow there, flashing lights. We did not see the red glaze or fog that we saw earlier at the base of the mountain. But I do see the outlines of what used to be a door. I'd swear. Mysterious things happening in Phoenix. Thanks to everyone for helping us put together this Phoenix Light Show. And we won't bore you with the facts of getting back down the mountain, but we'll make it back down. Thanks to Jane Swartley, our web production director, and to everyone who helped make this show possible. This has been a Phoenix Light Show.
You can't do a show about Arizona and UFOs without doing the Phoenix Lights. So let's play this. This was done on the 12th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights. And let's listen to this program of William Warwick.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
This didn't look like anything I'd ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.
William Warwick, good to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Jerry? It's been a while.
This is the anniversary of the Phoenix Lights, so it's a good time to have you back with us.
Yep. 12 years this Friday the 13th, which for those of you who follow occult studies is a propitious day.
Well, if it had been Friday the 13th, wow. I had not thought of that before.
No, I mean, if it was Friday the 13th, that would have been a humdinger. Nope, it was actually. Let me think. 14th was the day that I got fired, so that was Friday. That would have been the 13th. So it would have been.
Are you talking about getting fired because you saw a UFO and reported it?
Yeah. Yeah, I got fired on March 14th, which was 2 days after I saw the UFO, and that was the day after the Phoenix Lights.
William, I think it'd be a good idea to tell the listeners a little bit more about this. I mean, you're getting fired because you saw a UFO.
Well, back in 1997, I was working my way through college, working for a national plumbing company, and I was out on call, looking at a job, and I went out to my service vehicle to retrieve a business card, and on the way back in, that's when I saw the UFO. And about 15 minutes later, after I went back into the house and told the guy what I saw, went back out to the truck, got on my radio, and tried to find out if any other technicians in the area had seen anything. And that's basically it.
So you were kind of a victim of being a whistleblower, I guess.
That was in Norfolk, and that was all that I said about it. It was very brief. I mean, literally what I just said was what I said on the radio. I called in sick the next morning. I was a little freaked out, as you probably can imagine. That was the morning of March 13th, and then on March 14th, I called in sick again for totally different reasons. My boss showed up at my doorstep at like 9 o'clock in the morning, told me I was fired, took my truck away, my van, my tools, everything.
What did you see that night? I mean, the UFO. Was it worth getting fired?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that it wasn't voluntary. You know, it was... I didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on me.
Where exactly was this UFO?
Well, the craft that I saw was approximately 600 feet wide. It could have been as low as 300 feet wide, but I would say that it most likely between 400 and 600 feet wide from tip to tip. It was not a flying wing. It was not a B-2 stealth bomber. It was not a blimp. I'm familiar with all types of aircraft. I was a certified senior member of the Civil Air Patrol, taught in Air Squadron, 1990-1992. My job is to be the spotter. I had memorized just about every aircraft in the world, military and civilian, in James Encyclopedia when I was 16. I have kept for the most part, up to date with that. I did go to school for mechanical engineering. I did want to become an aeronautical engineering major, and I was very familiar with all flight principles. And what I saw just defies all of that. It throws everything out the window. Whether it was human or alien, and that's up for debate, was definitely an anti-gravity craft or some type of craft that nullified the effects of gravity due to the enormous increases in acceleration and deceleration.
Now, you've brought up Edgar Cayce with us before. You think he's pretty important in all of the scheme of things. And the Philadelphia experiment took place right about where you saw the UFO, huh?
Well, at that particular time, I was in a residential neighborhood which is situated and surrounded by a series of naval bases, which is basically called Norfolk Naval Base, but which is actually a series of different naval bases that are kind of all connected. So, in essence, we were surrounded by military infrastructure in the Norfolk, Virginia area. Interestingly enough, when I did more research about this particular geographical area, I found that this was also the area where the famed Philadelphia experiment allegedly took place.
Now, I know you're in the process of updating your website. I hope you put some stuff up there.
Yes.
I mean about Edgar Cayce and your research.
Yep. In fact, one of the most interesting connections that I was able to make was that Edgar Cayce, who was the renowned psychic that lived in the 1920s and died in 1945, actually located his hospital for healing people in Virginia Beach, and that particular latitude, for some reason, Bruce Cathy wrote a book about it called Harmonic Conquest of Space, which you can get, which you can still get your hands on. But for some reason, at that particular latitude, these experiments in space and time appear to be able to be conducted. We are going to have a new launching of UFOEyewitness.com, which is going to have all of the information that was going to be published in my books is going to be published on the web for free, basically. Everyone will be able to have access to that over the next few coming months as we upload stuff to the web. Basically, I spent a lot of time trying to find book publishers who are willing to do the books, and found that, you know, the percentage you get on that, for those of you who don't know anything about book publishing, the author might make 3% of list price, which is, you know, nothing.
So much for book publishing, but you do have a DVD out. How's that doing?
We just won an award for the best investigative documentary from the New York Independent International Film Festival. Very happy about that, and you know, we're just looking forward to making sure that people get this DVD and see the information that's in it, look at the evidence that's presented, and really make your own decision. We don't try to tell people what to think. We just try to present you with as much evidence as possible so that you can see what's really out there. And certainly the DVD is the only way to get that, because the mainstream media is just not covering it.
And you can order that on your website?
Absolutely. You can order it from UFOEyewitness.com. That's www.UFOEyewitness.com. And there's also a 800 number that you can call, 1-877. This is a toll-free call, by the way. 1-877-345-6222. Again, that's 1-877-345-6222.
And the price? $19.95, right?
So a couple of coffees at Starbucks, basically.
Now, this documentary, this DVD, is about the Phoenix Lights?
Yeah, all of the incidents related to the Phoenix Lights. A lot of people get focused on...
Now, we've done several previous shows with you, William Warwick, and I would suggest, in fact, I urge people to go over and listen to those shows. They can find that on your page right here on our site. We also have an associated link here. Basically, as I understand it, and as I remember our other interviews, you say there were a lot of things happening there in Virginia at the same time the Phoenix Lights appeared in Arizona.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, definitely in the previous shows we got into tons of detail about the various events that happened not only in Phoenix but coincidentally also here in Norfolk, Virginia. I mean, you had plane crashes, you had you have an incident with Governor Clinton on the evening of March 13th, which really has not been explained. I mean, there are just so many different events that happened within a very small period of time, most of them within a couple of hours of each other, certainly within double-digit hours of each other in terms of all of the events beginning to unfold. And I don't mean that just in terms of the Phoenix Lights or Norfolk Kitson in particular, but on an international level. There are events that happened in Brazil in January. There were events that happened in St. Petersburg, Russia, in February of 1997. So there were a lot of huge...
Can you refresh my mind about St. Petersburg and that incident? I mean, was it a huge craft? I think it was. Boomerang? Triangle?
You know, the reports are a little bit varied, but from what I understand... most of them were very similar to the types of reports that we got out of Phoenix and out of Norfolk, which were, you know, basically large triangular form or boomerang form craft. And we must remember that it's quite possible that, say, if you had three lights in the sky, you would automatically, most people would automatically connect those three points and call it a triangle, when in fact it could be a boomerang-shaped object like the craft that I saw. So, definitely... Around the world at that particular time, there seemed to be just this huge, unprecedented influx of UFO incursions in every country that you can imagine, with no seemingly clear indication as to where they might be coming from or who might be behind it, if it was human in nature, and if it was human in nature, what would be the purpose of it? Is it some kind of psychological operation that the government is doing to see what people's reaction to it would be? There are just so many unanswered questions to all these events that we really need to get to the bottom of it.
William Warwick, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we are going to talk to you about really what your conclusions are, if you've reached any after 12 years, about the Phoenix Lights and these other incidents around the world. All happening about the same time. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back with our guest, William Warwick, and our subject, among other things, of course, the Phoenix Lights. Marvelous Marv Grand Canyon Tours offers you a unique look at one of the great wonders of the world, the Grand Canyon.
Been at the Grand Canyon area most of my life, so pretty much grew up in the area and know quite a few things that the common tourist doesn't know, and I need to avoid all the people and stuff and try to take them to secluded areas.
A day excursion, personally, conducted by Marvelous Marv.
Yeah, we started about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're done about 4:30. Absolutely. And I have a little photo CD disc for them with 1,000 of my favorite pictures and some video. And
no other tour offers so much, and no other personalized tour offers a better price.
No, I'm still the same, and I'm the most reasonable price tour of the Grand Canyon now. $85 a person. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Call 928-707-0291 or check him out at MarvelousMarv.com. The Phoenix Lights incident happened 12 years ago. Wow, it just does not seem like it's been that long. William Warwick is our guest. He's on the line from his home in Norfolk, Virginia. William, when we went to the break, we were talking about similar incidents happening around the world, and some of them at exactly the same time that the Phoenix Lights was occurring in Arizona. Now, I know you have had a conference. You produced a documentary on this subject, and you've done lots of research on the Phoenix Lights. So let's start off this portion with the answer to the question, what do you make of all of this? I mean, have you come to a conclusion about the Phoenix Lights at all?
Yes, actually I have, and it's only been really in the past 6 or 8 months. After I went to the X conference with Stephen Bassett and met all those incredible other researchers there last year, I really began to think about why it was that after 60 years we still have America, at least, still hasn't tackled the UFO question. And the more research that I did as to why, the real reasons why this information hasn't been brought out, has to do with the fact that for 60-odd years, since roughly 1947, our government has really had a government within a government, which many have called the secret government, which has been really controlling how the progress of our country has taken place and in what direction it has gone. And what I mean by that is that if we assume that something really did happen in Roswell in 1947 and that some sort of alien crash vehicle event occurred, then that would certainly have sent shockwaves throughout the military and intelligence and government governmental bodies to the point that they would have formed what many ufologists have called, you know, the Majestic 12 or some sort of oversight board. And along with that oversight board, they would have been given an unlimited national security capacity to basically acquire whatever they needed to do, basically whatever they wanted to do. And with that carte blanche credit card to buy whatever they want and sell whatever they want, so to speak, and make whatever they want, they also had the national security what's the word I'm looking for? The national
Say apparatus.
To go along with it. And so, I mean, that's a pretty dangerous combination to have in any society, in any government organization, or any free society, let's put it that way. Now, if it's a dictatorship, if we're talking about Stalin or Hitler or something like that, then that's an excellent system to run your government and your people. But obviously, in America, that's not so good, because history has shown that absolute power corrupts absolutely. So, having said all that, if we fast forward 60 years into the future, and you listen to the former Comptroller of the United States, who just retired from his position before the election, he said that our actual deficit is between 50 and 55 trillion dollars, and that all of the candidates know about it, but they don't want to talk about it because they're afraid it's going to send us into an even more deeper recession. Now, the question that I have, Jerry, is if the official known documented so-called deficit is around $11 trillion, then where is the other 40-odd trillion dollars of our deficit? First of all, where has it gone to? And second of all, where is that money that went to that, where did it come from?
Now, those are all good questions. But the question is, do you have answers, Bill?
Well, I mean, if we start from the premise that that the United States government formed a secret group, a coalition of military-industrial complexes, which we'll just call it that because that's the most accurate definition of it, got together and formed you know, a secret society, so to speak, a secret group of individuals who would oversee the back engineering or the re-engineering of anti-gravity craft, whether that be you know, human-made craft from the Nazis or the Japanese, etc., although that's a true extraterrestrial vehicle, is probably not that important. But the point would be that from that point on, say around circa 1947, that a significant, I would say more than significant, amount of the gross domestic product of our country has been dedicated to things that and items that can never be sold. You know, you can't sell anti-gravity craft to anyone. That can never be revealed and because of the technology involved, which goes along with the first reason. And then the third thing is, how do you explain how you paid for it? So we really have a triple whammy of a situation where the government, or I should say the people that are in control of these technologies, or I should say the companies that are in control of these technologies, Boeing, Aerospace, you know their names, Lockheed, Bechtel, you know, some of the more obscure, EG&G, that's a big one, SAIC is another one. These companies are obviously dealing with anti-gravity technology, but the question is, if all of these programs are black budgets and they're not appropriated legally by the United States Senate, the question that I have is, where is that money coming from? There are really only a couple of revenue streams in the whole world that you can get tax-free that are very lucrative. And that and that don't require, you know, a lot of people asking questions. Well, one of those things is military arms and weapons, right? And drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not the first time that anyone has put together the, for instance, Air America back in the Vietnam era, where the CIA was dealing with, you know, getting drugs from South America and, of course, selling those drugs here, right here in America and abroad. You know, you've got the case of, you know, back in the 80s with the CIA selling crack to the, you know, the poor black people in L.A. And, you know, these aren't conspiratorial cases. These are actual historical documented facts.
You know, here at the Jerry Pippin Show, we're in the beginning stages of a series in development about drug money and our secret black operations, you know, government operations, off-budget stuff, and actually even protection of the pharmaceutical companies by the government. It's all intertwined, and it's centered around this huge amount of money that's out there that everybody's getting, receiving from illegal drugs. Now, I'm not talking about just the selling of it, but I'm talking about the enforcement aspect, the war on drugs itself. It's all a huge moneymaker.
Well, you know, one of the most important things that tells you what's going on in terms of, how do I explain this? The first state act of George Bush Jr., when he became president, the first thing he did, the first official state act that he did, was he went to Colombia, and he gave the president of Colombia $4 billion, with the B, $4 billion to quote-unquote fight drugs. Now, I mean, to me, that tells me that looks like a payment. I'm sorry. I mean, you could say that it's used to help fund, you know, the secret police there in Colombia, but I mean, $4 billion. I mean, for $4 billion, my God, does the whole Special Forces Command have $4 billion? The whole Special Forces Command of America, do they get $4 billion a year in their budget to play with? I mean, it's just, it's an insane amount of money for reasons that I think are highly suspicious. In fact, if you recall, what was it, Operation Something Fury, when George Bush Sr. sent the Special Forces in to get Noriega.
Yes.
Well, one of the scuttlebutts of that was that apparently all of the drug people put all of their money in Noriega's banks in Panama. Because that's just what you did. Well, supposedly Bush had a bunch of his money in there, and when Noriega took over the banks, he took over all the drug dealers' money, and of course Bush went down to straighten it all out and find out where the money was. Operation Something Fury, and that was back in 1989. So. Certainly, it seems as though there is a class within a class here in America, or there was a class within a class. Hopefully, with the new president, some things will change. But that felt that they had, you know, their own special privileges to do whatever they want, whenever they wanted, to whomever they want, and have been getting away with it for 60 years. And I think that the UFO situation is what gave them that power to begin with. And what is now ruining this country. Because if you think that $40 trillion has been spent on these programs over the past 60 years, and you think about where that money came from, I guarantee you half of it came from drugs. Now, they could use that justification on a higher level if they were to go to, you know, Nebraska senators or whatever, you know, the Midwestern Truman types, right, and say, listen, you know, we have to sell these drugs because if we don't sell these drugs, then we don't have any money to continue the UFO effort. And if we don't continue the UFO effort, then the aliens will take over the world. And so you have this huge house of cards built on a house of lies, which is now beginning to come crumbling down. And I think that the American people need to demand from their government accountability and an answer to the UFO question, because I really and truly feel in my heart of hearts that what I've heard from other people who have been doing this a lot longer than I have. I'm only 37. I've only really been doing this for 10 or 12 years. You know, for instance, Bill Cooper, if you remember William Milton Cooper.
Sure.
He said that that our country spends about $1 trillion a year, and he said this back in the 80s, on these secret black government projects. Well, you know, if he's right, and you do about $1 trillion a year since 1947, well, guess what? You come up with about $55 trillion. So when I did that in my head, and I realized when I connected A, B, C, D, E, and F, I said, my God, could this be the reason why we are in the financial debacle that we are in today? Because not only is it the money, Jerry, you know, it's not just the fact that elements of our government would be and are, you know, unquestionably involved in drug smuggling and selling it to our children, right? It's not just that, but it's the fact that so much technology that could be environmentally friendly technology is being suppressed, and so much talent on a national collegiate level is being sucked away from programs that could be benefiting our country right now and being put into these black programs. I mean, it's killing us. It's literally, I never thought in a million years that I would come to the point where I would say that the UFO cause is meeting all of the other causes that we should be fighting for, you know, here in America and on Earth as human beings. You know what I mean? I mean, I just find it...
You know, I think the major problem we have with official U.S. government disclosure of UFOs will be the money. We've spent a lot of money back engineering all of this, and most of it came from Uncle Sam, given in the form of secret... you know, contributions to corporations. I'm talking to military industrial complex corporations to develop these things, like maybe even the computer or the microchip, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these companies have the patents, and they've been making lots of money. And officially, if it were acknowledged, if they got these products by back engineering and financial help and backing from the U.S. government, then the lawyers would be out there filing class action suits on behalf of the taxpayers, as well as they should, and there would be a lot of money they would have to come up with to rebate to the American public, to the taxpayers. I can see how this would be a whole new can of worms for the Black Op boys. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, you know, I don't, yeah. That would be great. I mean, that's what I would absolutely have to agree with. That there's been one completely objective viewpoint that we can definitely show empirically is just by measuring the number of mainstream news stories that are being printed or shown on television about UFOs and UFO sightings. PRG. Paradigm Research Group has a great website if you want to check it out. UFO reports that have occurred since roughly around 1996, 1997, right around the time of the Phoenix Lights. And the amazing thing is that in the 1997 there were like 12 reports, and in 1998 it was 15, and then 20, and the next year it was 30, and the next year it was 60. I think it's up to about 250 a year now, mainstream. So clearly, the whole, not just the public's interest in it, but also the mainstream's coverage of it, which is going to increase the public's interest of it, has been growing exponentially. So I would agree. I think we are heading towards that point, but I still think that, you know, there is like we're at a critical junction right here, in the sense that the only time that real change happens, when you look through history, is when people are really dissatisfied.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Bill, about things, you know, getting bad before they get good. I know in the financial crisis, I just did a show on banking, and the prevalent theory around is that it had to get really bad, out of control, before anything would be done to correct it. So maybe the UFO thing will straighten itself up, you think?
Absolutely. You know, sometimes things have to fall apart and break down before you can get your hands in there and fix it. And so I really think that we have a tremendous opportunity here, especially in this upcoming year, you know, this from here on out, from basically the Phoenix Lights on. And I think anyone involved, and you call it a call to arms or whatever you want to call it, and, of course, you've been instrumental in that, Jerry, to really, we need to put together a political action committee. Stephen Bassett from PRG is a lobbyist by trade, and we need that. We need to have someone, a group in Washington that represents everyone's view about UFOs, whether they be skeptical or, I'm an adoptee, blah, blah, blah. I don't care. What I want is government accountability. What America needs to have is government accountability. And if we don't get it soon, if we don't do it in the next year, I think we're going to lose a tremendous opportunity to make that happen. And if we don't make that happen, I mean, there are a whole series of Orwellian consequences of us not dealing with this right here. And
consequences? Right. What are we talking about, consequences here, Bill? What consequences?
Some of them, the best layout that I have seen so far is by Grant Cameron. He beat me to the punch. He listed, and you can get this on his website, I think it's presidentialufos.com. Just look up Grant Cameron, you'll find him. And he listed the 64 potential legitimate logical reasons why the UFO reality has not been brought out by the government. In other words, why disclosure hasn't happened yet. So the issue is so complex on so many levels that there are so many reasons for not bringing it out, that it really does require, something like what we're experiencing now in America, this huge fallout all around the world and a questioning of our ideals and a questioning of our everything. This is a tremendous opportunity to put this secrecy to bed and to give not just America but the whole human race a new direction. Because if we believe in this capitalist system, in this free market economy system, okay, and I do, then you have to have what's called an expanding economy. You have to have, X amount of births per year and X amount of births deaths per year, 5% growth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I mean, there is a limit to what the Earth can sustain. So at some point, we've got to go into space. I think it's our destiny. I think that's where we came from. I think that's where we will return. And if we can focus our attention on that, the whole human race, like we did with the space race, and we could do it with going back to the moon, we could do it with going back to Mars. I mean, a Mars mission is estimated to cost $40 billion. I mean, only $40 billion? We just gave AIG $800 billion. What did we get for that? We got nothing.
Good point.
$40 billion, and everyone cries about it. But here again, the reason why we don't have a moon base on the moon, and the reason why we don't have a Mars base, is because the secret black government projects don't want anyone to be in their territory. That's their that's all their stuff. And so once again, it's not just a matter of our American economy. It's not just a matter of our civil liberties. It's a matter of the evolution of the human race.
In this program we did with William Warrick, we had to discuss Governor Symington. So listen, I think you'll find it interesting. Remember, first he made a big deal of it, then he made fun of it, then he recanted again.
I think America needs to hear this, and I'm sure that he wants to get it off his chest, though. And I recall Frances at one point saying that when she, originally saw the James Fox Out of the Blue interview with Fife, that he just looked to be, he looked like he was so relieved. She talks about this in our documentary, so relieved to get it off his chest. And I'm inclined to believe that. I'm inclined to believe that that the government put a lot of pressure on him to not investigate it. I certainly don't know why he would have said he was going to investigate it if that was not his intention.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That he was going to investigate it if that was not really, really his, deep down inside intention before going into the courtroom. Because certainly if he had been told prior to that, or if he had been...
circumstantially and all that, and that really is all we have, I mean, we weren't there. But someone or something obviously changed his mind.
Right.
And as far as I know, the judge's chambers was where he went, no place else, or at least that was the story we were told.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, Francis brought up a whole bunch of points, in our DVD. you know, how did, if he was in the judge's chambers for 5 hours and incommunication, incommunicado, and then got out, you know, who organized the emergency conference? Who got the costume for Jay to wear? You know, how did all this happen in between the time that he got out of the judge's chamber? And she made this point, you know, so it's sort of obviously...
You know, looking back over that press conference, I do think it took some time to prepare her for that press conference. Had to get that guy's costume, you know, and plan what they were going to say. So obviously, if he was in the judge's chambers all that time, he probably wasn't involved in creative writing, or maybe they were, I don't know. Someone helped him.
Exactly. And I think if anyone wants to go, you know, look out at the...
Yeah, that assistant's pretty interesting. I don't guess anyone's ever really talked to the assistant.
You know, I don't know. I don't know.
You know, I like to talk to the people around the major principal in a major story. In other words, as friends and acquaintances and other people involved. Sometimes that really, you know, helps you... You get to the bottom of it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, absolutely. And then that's why, you know, Francis has been a gold mine of, because I'm not from Arizona. You know, if I was from Arizona and this had happened in Arizona, I mean, we would have been a lot farther along in this investigation a long time ago. But obviously I wasn't. That's the way history happened. So, you know, but whatever. You know, and then here's the other thing, too. Here's the interesting thing. As if the story can't get strange enough, right? And actually your producer is the one that brought this up, so he's got to get credit for it. There's a connection here between Clinton. Clinton introduced Neo March 13th at 11:30 p.m. Now, 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in Florida, where Clinton was, is 9:30 p.m. Arizona time, or 8:30 p.m. Arizona time, excuse me,
mm-hmm.
when that was the exact time
right.
that Governor Simonton says he saw the UFO. Now, there's a connection between, and this, again, this, I got to give credit to your producer for this, I didn't get this. There is a connection between Clinton and Symington that goes back to the 1960s. Apparently, in Massachusetts, in the 1960s, Bill Clinton was swimming, you know, drinking, college party, whatever, got in some trouble out in the ocean, and guess who went to save him and pulled him to shore and apparently saved his life? None other than Symington. This is in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just connect the dots, I mean, do you think it's really that far out of fetch to say or to propose or to think that those two guys didn't call each other that night and one guy was asking the other guy what was going on?
From everything I've read, President Clinton was indeed interested in UFOs.
Absolutely, he was interested in UFOs. In fact, he was supposedly injured his knee. Now, here's another just bizarre fact. All right, Secretary Forrestal, if you recall, back in the 40s...
You're talking about James Forrestal.
Yep, allegedly committed suicide.
I think it's pretty clear someone
pushed him
out that window.
Right. Now, prior to him being sent to Bethesda, he had a meeting with Governor Symington's, I believe it's his great-uncle.
Yes, Stuart Symington.
Right.
Air Force Secretary.
There you go. So the Air Force Secretary, Stuart Symington, had some kind of conversation in a vehicle with Forrestal on the way to, I forget where they were going, I think it was Forrestal's house. Or they were going somewhere in Hobie Sound, this is 40, 50 years ago, and apparently Forrestal had a nervous breakdown after whatever Symington told him, and from Hobie Sound in Florida, Forrestal was taken directly to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and then, you know, subsequently, a couple weeks later, was pushed out the window. Now, the really bizarre thing about this is that Clinton was in Hobie Sound. Clinton, after allegedly having a phone conversation, well, I don't know that there was a phone conversation. I'm sure that there was. I'd love to find some kind of record of that. Probably called his buddy in Florida, because I'm sure NORAD was going crazy trying to figure out why the Mystery 3 satellite was shot out of the sky on the same night, right?
Mm-hmm.
Called his buddy down in Arizona. Hey, Fife, what's going on, man? You know, do you see anything? Yeah, I do, Bill. I see a huge 800-foot-wide boomerang floating over my head. Really? Next thing we know, Clinton allegedly introduced me, and he's whisked off to guess where? Bethesda. where he supposedly, you know, is has knee surgery.
I'm sure Clinton insisted on a ground floor room.
You know, I mean, well, I started thinking about that whole situation. I said, well, maybe, what if he's being debriefed? What if he's being debriefed? What if he never actually injured his knee? What if they kept him up in Bethesda for 3 days because they wanted to do a psych evaluation to make sure he wasn't going to lose the information to the public and to tell him what the deal was and here's the history and, you know what I'm saying? I have a feeling that something like that happened because of the similarity in the two events. It just seems so bizarre and strange to me.
We are about out of time, but let's remind everyone to get that DVD. They can go to your website and order it, right?
Yes, it's www.ufoeyewitness.com. And eyewitness is spelled EYEWITNESS.com.
So it's been 12 years after the Phoenix Lights incident, and frankly, we still don't have a clue.
Well, I would say we don't know. We cannot say for sure whether the boomerang-shaped objects that we saw were extraterrestrial or man-made. I think we can pretty much show without... I mean, I'm sure there are skeptical people out there who can always say that there's no connection between any of this stuff. But, I mean, if you look at the talking points that you got alone with 25 pages long... the evidence is there. If people want to look at the evidence, you've got the Phoenix Incident DVD, which we made. Please check it out.
So more than likely, you think it was extraterrestrial?
Oh, I, in one of our previous shows, which your listeners can look up, I believe it was all three. I believe there were probably at least one, perhaps two different extraterrestrial groups. As well as our own particular anti-gravity craft, which were set up. I think that if you look at the number of the varying degrees of reports, the reports can kind of be broken up into two different categories of ETs and then one category of known human, you could call them neutral buoyancy aircraft, which would be your, you know, your huge blimp-type vehicles, which are the huge, you know, triangular-type vehicles. I think they may have some boomerang-shaped vehicles. I don't know if what I saw can even be made by humans. It would have to be made in space, and that's based on, you know, my engineering background. But I would say that all of those possibilities can exist at the same time. Too many people get caught up in.
In other words, it does not have to be an either-or situation. As we say in the conspiracy business, it could be all of the above.
Right. Well, if the Russians sent their Tupolev bombers over our territory to invade our airspace, we would send our B-2 bombers up to invade their airspace. So it only makes sense that if they had foreknowledge of an invasion or a possible invasion or a possible visit by extraterrestrials, you know, traveling along with Hale Bopp and with the gamma ray burst that occurred on February 28th, which we covered in the last interview, certainly, we would send up our anti-gravity craft to meet their anti-gravity craft and see what happens, you know, at least to certainly to display our technology or to display that we have some capability of tracking them or what have you, although I think it would seem, you know, if given, like, the loss of aircraft that we had during that year, which we documented.
You're talking about Craig Buttons.
Actually, if you're interested, Jerry, I think we should, if you want to do a show, I would love to do a show just dedicated to the pilots and Craig Button, maybe on April 1st or April 2nd, right around that time period.
I think we could do something on April 2nd about Craig Buttons. What else are you working on, William? I mean, what is interesting to you right now?
Right now, the biggest story, and the most important story is definitely going to be the connection between the black budgets and our current financial crisis. Certainly, with the economy the way that it is, we need to look at everything. Everything that we do, from the way that we run our country and the Department of Defense to the way that we fund our schools. I mean, there's just so many things that need to be changed and need to be fixed. And UFOs should be at the very top of that list in terms of UFO disclosure and accountability as to where the money comes from and where it's going. And how do we get a $55 trillion deficit? You know, if what the former controller of the United States is saying is true, that all the politicians know about this, but they're not talking about it, well, how are we ever going to get out of the crisis that we're in? I mean, that's if what I'm saying is true, that these black budget programs and all the money and the brain talent and everything else that's been siphoned off into these things for 60 years now, if all of that is really what has led to where we are today, and they won't even acknowledge the fact that we have a $55 trillion deficit and not an $11 trillion deficit, then we're in big trouble.
Thanks for a very, very interesting hour.
Excellent, Jerry. Appreciate it, and I'll be talking to you soon.
I'm Jerry Pippin. This program was edited by Shane Swartley.